Coming up today, how machine learning is being used to predict crime in Rio, tough times for bees, and Intel makes its big virtual reality move. You're listening to episode 281 of the Wired UK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Matt Burgess.
Hey.
Hey. Nice. Pretty casual. Smooth. And you're leaning against a wall as well. And Jeremy White.
Hey there.
Hello. Matt Burgess, casual as you are, what did you learn this week?
I learnt a fact about the deepest dive a bird has ever done underwater. And I'm going to make you guess. I'm going to make you do multiple guesses, actually. What was the bird first?
What was the bird? Was it some sort of duck? Some sort of flying cormorant?
A gull?
Like
an emperor penguin. So you were both miles out there. Yeah. And it dived for 15 minutes. How deep did it go? We're talking, this is in the Antarctic, it's in the Ross Sea, so... It's a good distance.
This is just designed to make us look stupid, Matt. That's all this is designed to do. You've got the answer there in a paper in front of you, and we have to guess, I don't know, 300 metres.
30 metres.
Jeremy is a lot closer. It was 534 metres. And it was
down?
Yeah. And it was in a study where some researchers were basically looking how five different birds and how deep that they dived, and they measured like 1,600 dives underwater.
So half a kilometre.
Yeah. It's
no wonder they're emperor penguins. Penguins.
I've been down 30 metres and I got pissed, basically. Narcosis, they call it, basically. But
like, the technical term.
Yeah, so I was 500 metres down, that was one drunk penguin.
Jeremy, what did you learn this week?
I learned a couple of things, product related. I learned how stonkingly loud the new Phantom Gold from Debiolet is at 4,500 watts per speaker.
And we've got two.
We've got two in the office. We're trying them out this week. But actually, rather embarrassingly, as a journalist, it's not often great to admit you don't know certain words. People think you're some sort of walking lexicon or thesaurus. Or dictionary as being what we do, but that's just not the case. So actually, I heard a couple of my colleagues using the word defray the other day, and in my advancing years, I was really embarrassed to not know what this actually meant. I went and looked it up. And what I actually did, I had to go around the office saying, who knows what this word means? And virtually no one did. So I'm calling out the whole of the Wired office here that they didn't know what it means.
No idea.
Exactly. Well, it means to provide money to pay a cost or expense. So basically, the proceeds from the raffle help to defray the expenses of the evening. It's Roland Manthorpe's word of the day, which is going to be a regular feature from now on. But basically,
if Roland gets his way.
Yes. But anyway, new word for me, and it doesn't happen that often, but I was embarrassed not to know.
So the listeners of the Wired podcast can now go out and use defray in their conversations.
Absolutely. I'm going to defray this against my beer tonight.
Brilliant. It sort of works. I learned that Sellafield, which is a giant nuclear fuel reprocessing and decommissioning site in Cumbria, northwest England, literally has, and fans of The Simpsons will know what I'm going on about here, it literally has an everything's okay alarm. So this is an alarm that sounds constantly to tell them, to tell the workers on a big nuclear site that everything is fine and dandy.
So 24/7 it's going on?
Yeah. Well, maybe this, no, I imagine the site's manned 24 hours a day. So yes.
Please tell me it's a repeating mantra of everything's fine.
Everything's fine. And then everything's not fine. No, it's a ticking noise. It's like a dong, 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 dong noise. Yeah.
Oh, that won't drive you crazy.
Apparently, you learn to get used to it. A bit like if you live next to rail tracks. Anyway, Matt Burgess, bees. We said there was bad news for bees.
Yeah, it's not good news for the bee community this week and also in the last few years, basically, because a new study... looking at 18 years of recorded data from across the UK, so from 1994 to 2011, has concluded that the wild bee decline is wild bee population is going down in numbers,
and quicker than was necessarily thought. And the reason behind this is an insecticide.
Yeah, so it's the insecticide that is actually used for this is called a neonicotinoid. I may have pronounced that wrong and probably won't try and pronounce it again for the rest of the podcast.
Neonicotinoid.
That's probably closer to what it is. But this type of insecticide has been sprayed and on crops, and particularly oilseed rape, or rapeseed oil, as it's often known as, across the UK. And loads of other countries around the world have banned it, but we still use it here. And we've actually been using it since around 2002, which basically meant for the researchers, this data, which had all been collected by volunteers over the last 18 years, they had 9 years up to 2002 and then 9 years after. So they had a before and after, basically two different control groups to look at,
so they could see at that point what happened and compare the two periods.
Yeah, so they did it over the whole period. So they looked at different areas of the UK, and I think they would split the UK up into small chunks of the country where bees were found, and they looked at what the effect of this rapeseed oil was
on the rapeseed oil. But to my mind, this isn't particularly new. We've known that bees have been having a bit of a hard time for quite some while. But this research is not groundbreaking, but it brings together an awful lot of thinking around the decline of bees and provides some real evidence.
Yeah, so it's a lot more comprehensive than what has actually been done before. So previous studies around this type of insecticide and rapeseed oil have been done, but they've been done on a small scale. So they've only looked at three different types of bee in the past, which are basically bees that you can breed artificially. So honeybees, buff-tailed bumblebee, which is a great name for a bee, and the red mason bee. These are the ones that have been studied in the past, and there's been loads of different research around this. And I think in one of the cases, honeybees, actually those that eat the rapeseed oil with this insecticide on, have actually had a lowered sperm count, which obviously has an impact on the population. So in this latest study, they looked at a lot more data. They looked at 250 types of bees around the UK, and then they basically whittled this down to a group of 62 bees, species of bees. So these bees, these 62 groups, were those that fed on rapeseed oil, didn't feed on rapeseed oil, and also were the most ones that they had data on. So they basically took out that there's 250 types of bee in the country, and they just disregarded the data for those that they didn't have enough on. And those that did eat the rapeseed oil were declining three times as fast.
So hang on a minute. Am I getting this right? So for years we've been talking about the decline of the bee population.
Yes.
And the answer for years has been, well, we're not quite sure why this is happening. And it turns out the answer is we've been using insecticide.
it's always been linked to insecticide, but it was nailing the specific
which one it was. Okay. Yeah. But I thought when they were turning around saying we don't quite know why this is happening, that meant, well, I thought someone would have ruled out insecticide and say, well, you know, that's the first place you go.
But so, it's worrying that it's been banned from use in lots of other countries, but that we're still using it 9 years later in the UK. And maybe this study will make people in positions of power sit up and listen and say, well, for the good of the bees, let's stop using it.
Yeah, I think that's what this is partly designed to do, but it's just using data from a long term to prove something that we already sort of knew.
Yeah.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, it's a bloody good thing.
Especially if you're a bee. But there are things that you can do at home right now to help the bees. Do we all have gardens?
Yes.
I don't. I've just got a balcony.
Do you have bee-friendly plants in your garden, Jeremy?
I try to.
And you see them coming in and enjoying them, and then more bees come when they get the good news from the dancing.
Always very nice to them when they turn up. Yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
You know, like leave out little dishes of honey for them to...
say hello.
Yeah. All right, our second story this week. Jeremy, Intel are the latest big tech company, and probably one of the last big tech companies, to make their big virtual reality announcement. And it is a big one.
Absolutely right. Yeah, the announcement of Project Alloy this week from Intel. Now, what I liked about it, compared to the other offerings that are out there at the moment, from the HTC Vive, from the Oculus Rift, from the PlayStation, and the Open Secret that obviously Microsoft are working on one for the Xbox, the idea with the Project Alloy is that it requires no separate computer whatsoever. It is untethered in its entirety. So all the computing power is built into the headset itself. So you just plop this headset on, which looks massive, and it must weigh a ton. I'm not sure how much it weighs. But you put this on, and therefore you are ready to go, and you can walk around untethered in a virtual space. Now, it also uses the RealSense cameras that have Intel technology and full-depth sensors, which allow it to give you five-finger tracking. And what they mean by that is that the cameras themselves are so sensitive that they're able to track your individual digits as you move them around in front of the headset, so you can manipulate things in the virtual space. Not only that, it uses those cameras to merge reality. You'll understand why I've used that word. To merge reality with what you're seeing in the headset. So when you bring your hands up towards the headset itself, they appear as if out of nowhere in the virtual world. So you can use your hands, and regardless of what you've got on or anything like that, you don't need a controller, no hand controllers here like with the Vive or the Oculus, to manipulate stuff in the virtual space, but actually seeing your hands in the virtual space as well. Not only that, of course, because the cameras are there, they can actually recognize other objects as well. So if you want to use a pen that you've got in your hand, or you want to use a pound note or anything like that.
A
pound note. Well, the demo they used was a dollar bill, but we're British, goddammit, and I didn't want to say that.
Go to the Channel Islands and you can still get a pound note. Anyway, exactly. I digress.
So anyway, basically, this thing allows it, they call it merged reality rather than virtual reality or mixed reality.
So this starts to get confusing. So yeah. Virtual reality is where you are completely, or it's just an umbrella term for everything, yeah, but where you are completely
in a virtual space. That's
then
right.
There's mixed reality, which is Magic Leap, which lets you
overlays some sort of display or virtual reality overlaid on what you can actually see in the real world.
That's Magic Leap and HoloLens.
Yeah.
Then there is now merged reality.
Yeah, which basically brings the real world or footage of the real world, i.e. footage of your hands, you know, relate into the virtual world.
But it's so recreating them virtually.
It is, but it's real time. And so that's the whole thing, actually. This, what's so clever about the Project Ally headset is that it 3D scans the room it's in real time. So you can walk around. It means you don't bump into walls or into furniture, because as something comes towards you, there it does. The corner of a room or a corner of a chair suddenly appear in the virtual space to let you know you're right next to it. In much the same way as when you're using the HTC Vive, but it maps the room for you with the cameras and lets you know a sort of outlined view of your room. So, like, oh, you're now coming to the end of your 6 foot square space. This will actually show you what's directly in front of you, whether it's a lamp, whether it's a corner of a furniture, whether it's a door. And so theoretically, you should be able to move around your house using this system and not actually bump into anything as it maps it live. So that's the impressive part of it, is everything's on board, and it means that you're not tied to one specific area.
And Matt, a few months ago in San Francisco, you got to try out some of the precursor technology, or was it the actual RealSense stuff that Intel is now debuting?
So it was the RealSense stuff that I tried out in California a few months ago. It's actually a technology that they've been developing since about 2014, I think. But the way I saw it was basically, I guess it's a chip, and sensors that are on this chip was connected to a phone, and that was just scanning the room and, like, basically mapping the room in front of you. And then they put it into a virtual world, and I saw somebody walking around a room with this, and there was a waterfall in front of them in a virtual world, and then they put their hand into the waterfall and it sort of disrupted the water. They also pushed objects over, like during a game that they were playing. And this wasn't, the technology wasn't actually put into a headset at this point. It was just, they had developed this, and there was clear thinking behind it, as in, we've got this here in front of us, this is what we can do. And then, oh look, a few months later they put it into a VR headset. Yeah.
But there is a bit of a caveat here. You're not actually going to be able to buy the bleeding thing.
No, you're not. But the good thing is, I mean, obviously this is a concept design from Intel, but the good thing is, though, that next year they're going to make the development kit for this headset available to third parties so other people can build it. So obviously using Intel technology, of course, and there's the hook. But what it means is that they've gone about developing stuff like this and then said, okay, right, other people can go ahead and run with it using our technology. So this will come to market.
But what we're waiting for is which big technology company will come along and, because, well, it's not going to be Facebook and Oculus.
No.
It's not going to be Microsoft. It's not going to be Sony.
Yeah.
Does that mean that Apple is the company that licenses technology? Because in order for it to be a success, it's late to the party. It's someone big, and there's not many big players left. Someone big is going to have to pick it up.
This is just the sort of thing that Apple does. come late into a market and leapfrog everybody. But basically, something, you know, someone will definitely pick this up. Some major corporation will pick this up, or you know, a smaller corporation will pick this up. You will be able to buy this technology. It's just the way this has to go. I mean, a lot of people have been worrying about virtual reality in tech world, saying, is it the next 3D? Is it the next sort of disappointing area of tech where everyone thinks it's going to be amazing, but actually it's not? And it's this sort of development that is absolutely necessary to allow this technology to be taken up in the mainstream. People at the moment are not buying it because no one wants to build a super high-end consumer PC in their living room.
Most people can't afford to
afford
build
it.
One.
But most people don't know how to do it, don't know how to operate it. We're the console generation or the tablet or phone generation. You don't know how to go mucking about with computers. And also, you know, you don't want to have a dedicated space, a 6-foot by 6-foot space in your room.
And a tether.
And a tether for it as well. I mean, you know, it's all of these things have to go eventually to make virtuality a long-term possibility. And this is the first time where anybody's come along and actually tried to address that and go, this is actually how we can do it. And actually, it's come along quicker than I thought. So I'm really excited by this, and I'm excited to see where it will be taken.
Big questions to answer. The weight, as you mentioned earlier,
yeah,
this thing
definitely.
Might feel a bit like having a large dog strapped
to your head. It looked like huge. You'll definitely get neck ache wearing this.
Weight, concert. And that also brings in the question of battery.
Yeah.
So that's probably why it's so heavy, that they're having to squeeze an awful lot of battery power into it. And price,
exactly,
of course.
Exactly. All of which we cannot answer.
No, and probably won't answer for well over a year. So keep listening. Our third story this week takes us to Rio de Janeiro in Brazil, where machine learning is being used to predict where crimes will take place. The service is called Crime Radar and is an app for desktop and mobile that draws on 5 years of crime data, that's 14 million crimes in Rio de Janeiro, to work out where offences are most likely to occur in the future.
So this is predicting crimes, or crime, where crimes might happen.
It's like a less crappy version of Minority Report. I suppose. And Minority Report's always one of these films that it's kind of, it's stuck in people's minds as this sort of cultural whatever point. And every so often, bits of it come true. And now, thanks to machine learning in Rio, a little bit of it is coming true. But you might think, well, why Rio? So in a 2015 poll of 81% of Brazilians, said they feared becoming a victim of homicide, which I guess isn't that surprising. Surely everyone fears becoming a victim of homicide, but I think the point is that it felt likely.
Actively fear it.
Yeah. According to one watchdog, there were 58,000 homicides in Brazil in 2014, which is pretty bad. And 32 of the 50 most dangerous cities in the world, as measured by homicide rates, are in Brazil. And of course, it's slightly timely with the Olympics being in Rio and there being reports of some genuine crimes and some perhaps slightly less genuine crimes. But we'll put that one to one side. So the app works by taking data that's been made recently publicly available and interpreting it in clever ways using machine learning and using algorithms. So basically, when you open it up, you see a Google Maps, Google Earth-like view, and you're able to look at crimes that occurred in the past and what kind of crimes they were. But then the clever bit is the algorithm, the machine learning, takes that data and shows you where crimes are likely to happen in the future, which is very, very clever.
And how does it, if I can ask, how does it actually do that in the sense of, is it working purely on past data, and or does it take into account current data in order to modify where crime is actually going to appear?
So I'm not sure how regularly they'll update the data, which I guess is part of that question. So will it just stay at this point, but I presume they'll keep adding more recent crime data because that will obviously change the data that it puts out there for future crimes. So it looks at the risk of crime in different parts of the city by finding patterns and incidents. So this will be locations and times, and then algorithms look at these GPS coordinates and times and dates and types of crime to work out the specific risk of specific crimes occurring at specific times. So say, for example, you're planning to take a walk in Rio as a tourist, you could use this app to pick, to dodge around areas where you're more likely to be stabbed, assaulted, kidnapped, raped, robbed, using guns or knives or etc., etc. So you can look at the data by the different risks and the level of severity. So what you get is a heat map, in effect.
Yeah.
From green, meaning it's pretty safe, to red, meaning and you can plan accordingly. And while it would be really interesting if a company were to put this into a normal navigation tool like City Mapper or Google Maps or even, I guess, Uber. You could plan to have a taxi ride that avoided dangerous areas.
Well, there was a government website, probably still is actually in the UK, where you could where it actually mapped total reported incidents. So you could see a map of the UK and so going from green to red, detailing whether you were in, you know, crime infested boroughs or not. So you could actually choose where you wanted to live depending on the crime statistics.
And the difference here is that if you were to look at 7 o'clock at night, it would give you different data to if you were to look at 4 o'clock in the morning or whatever it might be. So it gives you how areas change overnight. And I suppose some areas can become a lot more threatening at certain times of day. Police could also use the tool, according to the people that have created it, to help them work on a scheme known as proximity policing. So this is the idea of having police, somewhat obviously, where crimes are likely to occur, but having them there at the right times and with much more specific data on what sort of crimes, so I guess they're better prepared to deal with them. And it could be coming to other cities and areas too. So as well as updating the original app, there are also plans to roll out similar apps elsewhere, but it all depends on there being the relevant data available and I suppose that data being updated regularly. So discussions apparently are currently ongoing in Latin America and the States.
I think that's one of the big things about this app as well, because there's not that much data on Rio in general that is actually reliable and trustable. So the people that made this actually said that some areas, such as favelas and poorer areas in the city, they haven't been able to use this for yet because the crimes that happen there and the crimes that are reported to police, well, they don't get reported half the time. They are just like, these happen and nobody tells anybody about the crime. So if the data's not there, they can't do this. And I think they may have done this as well to highlight that sort of that element too, that there needs to be a better recording by police and people to report crimes in certain areas of the city.
But it is a really clever use of data. But I am struggling to... Is this a good thing? Would people actually want to use this data when visiting a city?
Absolutely. Actually, I was just thinking of an incident directly for me. A few years ago, I went and visited Atlanta. And came out of my hotel, turned left, went down the street, carried on walking. And a guy just came up to me and said, "What the hell are you doing here?" And I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "What are you doing here?" And he escorted me out of the area. Very nice guy. He said, "Like, you just don't want to be walking around here." And he just walked me back up. And as he was walking me back out of this particular area, this couple of blocks, people were started hollering and, you know, shouting. And he said, "Like, no, it's with me, leave him alone." And out I went. And had I had something like this, I was just bimbling along, stupid British guy abroad, and just going, "Oh, I'll be all right, it's the middle of the day." No, certainly not. So I would certainly have liked an app like this had in that situation.
There we go. It's called Crime Radar. Go and check it out. There's a really, really good in-depth story on wide.co.uk with lots more details and some interviews with the people behind it as well, so it's well worth checking out. Right, so as mentioned on the podcast last week, the first ever Global Wired 100 is out now. This is our list of the movers, shakers, money makers who are shaping our culture, technology, economy, and scientific discovery. Pretty much, you name it, we've considered people from those industries, from those spheres of influence, whatever you want to call it. The full list and our reasons for picking who we picked are in the latest issue of Wired magazine, and you can also check out the list online at www.wired.co.uk/article/wired-global-100. Yes, our URL structure is a bit complicated. But what I want to know is who really caught your eye and why? Jeremy White.
Well, the thing is with this list is that you could, as it's a Wired list and, you know, it's our world, you could, you know, these are 100 people that we think are interesting. So, no, I've gone for a theme and I'm trying to work down there, but we could have picked any of them really.
So everyone in the Wired office and our contributors helped to write this, to pick the people that are on it. We got in touch with hundreds of people in our network. So it's a really, really broad canvas.
Yeah,
which
definitely is
why there's some names on here that I've never heard of.
Well, you'll have heard of these two. Thank you very much. So I haven't gone particularly out of the box. I'm appealing to the masses here. You guys are going to choose some more out of the box suggestions. But I'm going for, first of all, in the Global Domination 1, I'm going for Taylor Swift, who came in at number 61.
Are you a fan?
I am a fan. That's why I've chosen. I am a fan. I will come out on this podcast as I actually a fan. God help me. Well, there God we go. Help me. I'm actually a fan of Taylor Swift.
But justify, so why do you think she was on the list and why is she so interesting?
Okay, well, first of all, you've got to admire her power in the industry. She's distributed by Universal, one of the biggest companies out there in the world, on doing this sort of thing. But also she signed, though, to a small independent label. So she's completely autonomous in her decision making and has made that evident throughout her career. And so she cannot be pushed around on anything, even down to the artwork, cover artwork and things like that. So she definitely does exercise her power for someone of her young years. Also, her social media dominance is almost unassailable. 84 million Instagram followers, 80 million Twitter followers, 75 million Facebook followers. And I think a really good example of how she used this power very, very well was when XL Records started a fight with Apple over their Apple Music free trial, where they were Apple Music weren't going to pay the artists any royalties from this free trial that we're putting out. XL, who represent people like Adele, were very much against this and really tried to do it, but no movement from Apple. It's very difficult to get them to move on this sort of thing. However, after Taylor Swift posted on her Tumblr feed, I think within hours of posting on this, there was a turnaround, a U-turn from Apple, effectively saying sorry, and we are going to now pay the royalties. So that's just one example of the power she has in this. She also did something like this as well with Spotify, with their freemium model, and we objected to that, actually, when she released her 1989 album, and removed all of her music from Spotify. So fans were forced to actually go out and buy the music. It's a very old world concept of that, but they actually forced to go out and buy the music. And it turned out she actually sold 1.2 million copies in the first week of that album, which is the most for any album release since 2002. So other things as well, when she shared a picture of her running on a treadmill to Drake's Jumpman track, that resulted in a 431% hike in iTunes sales within a week. So this is just an example of someone with a serious social media clout globally and has the power to actually reverse massive corporate decisions
and
by major
companies.
And
serious business intelligence
exactly,
as well.
Exactly. I mean, this is not by chance that it's instance after instance after instance. Where she exercises this power and really just gets her own way.
It's pretty easy to dismiss this. Oh, it's just Instagram followers. Oh, it's just Twitter followers. You know, you're famous. You're going to accrue them just like most people, I don't know, accrue parking fines. That's a terrible analogy. But, you know, that they just happen because they happen. But they don't.
No. This is calculated. And this is a really clever mind at work. And then she goes and writes songs like Shake It Off. So I leave it there as far as that's concerned. So to have those abilities and that artistic ability as well, whether you like pop or not, you cannot dismiss this person.
Your next selection from the list is somewhat different.
Okay, yeah, somewhat different. Okay, global domination number two. My second choice is Reed Hastings coming in at number 36. So talking about subscribers, Reed Hastings, obviously, running the show at Netflix. We're our friendly neighbourhood video streaming service. Now, Netflix itself has 83 million subscribers, paying subscribers, let's say, paying subscribers around the world. And so much so that their reach is now global, as I say, global domination. They're available everywhere in the world apart from mainland China, Syria, North Korea and the Crimea. So basically, this is a company that has very quickly managed to extend its reach into every corner of the globe.
And with the global domination thing, so this was around CES in January, they literally, I'm sure not literally, but they flicked a switch,
yeah,
and immediately launched in something like 160-something countries.
Ridiculous, isn't it? I mean, it's an amazing proposition to be able to expand in that manner. Yet, actually talking to Reed Hastings, when Wired UK talked to Reed Hastings, he actually said that he considered the company really small and they were just at their beginning, which is scary, really. But, I mean, there's all sorts of things. I mean, you know, anyone who signed up at the beginning will now be experiencing the price hikes, your monthly price hikes. So you would have gone from that introductory offer from about £5 up to about £8. You know, there are problems with the service, in my opinion, and it's not exactly ideal. And so what's surprising is that this company has done so well when really it is not an ideal service. I mean, the UI itself is not particularly friendly to navigate. I mean, you know, it's not bad, but it's not fantastic. It could certainly be a lot better. The content offering, what people don't talk about often, they like to, Netflix like to say about how much there is available on there. But if you actually, say you're like me, if you're a massive sci-fi fan, and you go into the sci-fi section of Netflix, yeah, you've got a couple of real blockbusters there, and then it goes down, you've got a couple of really dodgy ones, you know, dodgy films from a couple of years ago. And then all of a sudden, you're in this sort of sea of B movies and C movies and basically terrible things that you would never have even picked up at your, you know, fusty old video shop either. So it's being bolstered by loads of content, but it's been bolstered by stuff that's virtually cost them nothing to put into different markets, yeah, because no one wants to watch them anyway.
It's interesting how them, and I think Amazon as well, have started talking differently about the sort of stuff that's available on their platform. So before it was all about the big numbers, you know, yeah, 4,000 this, 10,000 that. But now Netflix, very big focus on original shows that they have complete control over. They can release simultaneously worldwide. They've just signed up Black Mirror from Channel 4, which, yeah, is going to be screening in November. A really, really big deal for them. They've got things like Stranger Things, Orange is the New Black, Making a Murderer, which they're commissioning a new season for as well, I think.
Yeah.
And that's the big play. It's the cream on top of, as you say, this sea of, yeah, B movies, C movies, Z movies.
But then, so what are we paying for? Are we paying for effectively a Netflix channel, or are we paying for a video service, which is, you know, which is what they purport to be?
Like, I pay for a Netflix channel,
okay,
plus Attenborough, because they have a lot of the BBC Attenborough stuff, and that's pretty much all.
And
I,
you're
watch
happy
on
with
there,
that, and a lot, yeah, of people are happy with that. But when the company, when the companies say that actually we've got, you know, so many thousand titles, everything you want you could possibly have there, you know, and it's constantly being updated, the reality isn't quite up there. I mean, there's no, another reason why Reed Hastings is on the power list, apart from the reasons we've already mentioned, is that this area, you know, they are the very front, you know, very vanguard of where we're going in this particular field of streaming media. For example, you know, Hulu has just signed, the American service, streaming service, has just signed a major deal with Time Warner, and you've got Amazon, of course, as well. And also, Netflix are finally considering the idea of turning on offline viewing for Netflix, which is, people have been asking about and desperately want as well. However, no VR. I mean, they are not going down the VR route, not yet anyway. So yeah, that's the hard line from Netflix at the moment.
And when you look at how bad other streaming services are, I don't need to name them, and I'm sure people have got examples from the countries that they're listening to us from, there's a lot of really, really bad ones out there, and much as Netflix has its errors, its problems, it's pretty good.
It's fantastic. I subscribe myself. It's like, I wouldn't do that if I didn't think it was worth it. I just want it to be better. These things could definitely be better if we if we demanded it. I think it's one of those things where, you know, the promise doesn't quite deliver on the experience. And if they just made the promise a little more realistic, then you'd think this is a fantastic service. And I love it too, but I want more sci-fi, goddammit.
And that would take it from 83 million paying subscribers to 160, 200 million, 300 million, which I'm sure is what Reed Hastings and Netflix's shareholders would dearly like. Matt, your first choice isn't actually a person. Well, it kind of is, but we don't really know who it is.
Yeah, exactly. So coming in at number 21 on the list, and this is a person. Well, one of the things about the list is that people will disagree with it. And sometimes we disagree with it, and sometimes external people disagree with it. But it's been created sort of a collaboration. But I don't agree that this person, or this idea of a person potentially, should be at number 21. So my first choice of people on here is Satoshi Nakamoto.
And that person is the creator of Bitcoin, who may or may not be a guy from Australia, is right?
Craig Wright. So Bitcoin, the digital currency, was created in around 2009, 2010, and the person who created it signed off on their sort of online postings, online blogs about how this was created under the name of Satoshi Nakamoto. And since then, people have been trying to discover who this mysterious person is. And in the 4 or 5, 6 years since Bitcoin was created, nobody's actually been able to find out. So a number of publications have named people as being Satoshi Nakamoto around the world, and they've all denied it. It's all sort of been a really big mystery and a bit of a conspiracy in some cases. And most recently, an Australian guy called Craig Wright came out and said he was the founder of Bitcoin. He said he was Satoshi Nakamoto.
And everyone immediately went, no, you're not. And we can prove it. So it's difficult. But why do you think that whoever this person is shouldn't be on the list?
Because I think Bitcoin is important. Is it? There is a lot of currency that is around, that it's worth a lot of money these days. And blockchain, the underlying technology behind it, is incredibly important as well. And that's being developed by governments, by multiple companies around the world, and has potential applications of verification across multiple fields, industries. So ID, I think self-driving cars, it could also be involved in, and basically keeping a public record of stuff. So it could really be influential and important. But I don't think the person who created it is actually that relevant in 2016, because we don't know who they are, and they're not actually doing anything to further this.
6 years, 7 years ago that the first mentions of Bitcoin started to crop up and blockchain started to crop up. So you're right, it has been an awful long time. But then there's this weighing of, well, none of these innovations would be possible without the original innovation. But you're right, it is a really, really long time since, in technological terms, since Bitcoin first came on the scene.
But if Craig Wright, the person who claims to have invented it, could actually prove it and say that he was, then I think he should be on the list at this time.
Because he's tried.
Yeah, he has tried
very hard, but the internet is difficult to convince. What was your second choice?
So my second choice was somebody that I think should be higher. So coming in at number 79 was Jonah Peretti, the founder and CEO of BuzzFeed. We all know what BuzzFeed is, but it's gone a long way from being cats and stuff and lists of cats, gifts and everything like that. This year and last year, it's done a lot of serious news investigations, a lot of massive stories around the world. BuzzFeed broke some stories around cheating scandals, potentially in tennis. They've done a load of stuff in the UK around the National Crime Agency and their court proceedings, and basically have got a load of stuff struck off, a load of old court cases struck off where their evidence wasn't correct. And basically, I think they created a model that is very good, but now they're finally making it a serious model and have been doing so for 2015, 2016.
And they've got lots of money, which a lot of media organizations do not have. So they're able to hire the best journalists. They're able to hire really, really clever people to look at data and to work with stories in new and interesting ways. So as you say, it's moved a long way, but there's still a lot of cat gifts, pandas doing silly things.
Yeah, I just think it has matured to a stage where it is a very, very credible news organisation and has been for a couple of years, and is now changing how people look at media organisations, look at advertising. So they've done native advertising for a little while, and this is being successful for them. I think they have had to make some job cuts and potentially didn't make as big a amount of money as they did want to last year, but they have changed the landscape and they are showing what in the media industry can be done.
It's difficult to say this as we work for another media organization without sounding churlish, but is 2 years enough to 2 years of developing a stronger relationship, a stronger reputation in the news gathering field, is that enough to say we've changed our reputation? Like, for example, other publications like New York Times, you know, Financial Times, they build those reputations on not only decades but, you know, centuries sometimes, and when you're talking about turning something around, but for 2 years now they've been going in a new direction. That is great to see, and I really, you know, applaud them for that. I just, part of me wants to say, okay, that's still a very short period of time.
I think it is a short period of time, just on the basic facts of it. But the company is very young; things move very fast these days. Startups raise millions, hundreds of millions of dollars within weeks, months, years. And I think for a company like BuzzFeed, one of the challenges for them in the next coming years needs to be getting over that general, reputation it had built up originally for being gifts and all a lot of lighter content. Whereas now they are doing a lot stronger, and I think to get that view out in the public, in wide public opinion, is one of the difficulties that they will have. But I think the results of what they're doing is working.
Well, they're certainly pulling in high-profile journos, without a doubt. And it's amazing how success changes people's perceptions of certain brands, you know, like, you know, even down talking to people like, you know, the Trump, you know, when he announced his nomination, everyone thought it was ridiculous. And then now he actually is the candidate. People are taking it far more seriously. And for example, those sort of things, when a site is known for doing cat gifs and making, you know, list jokes and things like that, you know, suddenly starts to become tremendously successful. It changes everyone's perception of that. It's this idea that success actually brings this aura of credibility to it as well. And if they can capitalize on that and then take this forward, you know, like it really, they could be on an absolute fast track into being a very, very serious global media contender, wouldn't they?
You say number 79 on the list, should it not be higher? You think higher?
I brought them in this discussion. I think they should probably be in the top 50.
So someone that was in the top 50 and in the top 10, and maybe even then should have been higher, is a Danish politician who currently serves as the European Commissioner for Competition. Sounds dull? Well, not if you're Google. Margrethe Vestager was appointed in November 2014, and she wasted no time in launching investigations into the alleged anti-competitive behaviours of Google, Amazon, Gazprom. And she's also pursuing investigations into the tax affairs of Starbucks, Fiat, Apple and Amazon. So it's a bit like a who's who of really big tech companies. And arguably her biggest work to date are the two ongoing investigations into Google, one around online search and one about Android. And she's got huge, huge power for a politician. She can fine a company if they're found guilty of anti-competitive behavior, and these cases take years and years. She can fine them 10% of their annual global turnover, which for Google, I think, is well in excess of $4 billion, which is a crazy, crazy sum of money. And the European Commission has got past history on this. They were successful against Microsoft and caused a very, very big change in how Internet Explorer was pushed on consumers. The result of that is that you probably now don't use Internet Explorer. So this is a woman who could really, really radically alter how Google operates in Europe, both on Android and on online search, if she can get these accusations, these arguments to stick. It's going to run for years and years, but it's absolutely fascinating. And it's this difference between how Europe sees market dominance and how America sees market dominance. And it's a really, really great pick, I think, on the list. And perhaps even then she should be higher than seven.
And she's the top woman as well?
She is the top woman, yeah. So the case against Google and Android should come to a head in a few months when Google submits its response. And from there, it will probably run and run for years and years. But it could mean that the way Android works is radically different in the future. Ditto, online search could be radically different in the future if she can push through these accusations. And what's super interesting, and I can't remember the name of the guy that she took over from, it's Almunia maybe. Anyway, he was ready to strike a deal with Google based on years and years of negotiation.
Like,
and she
deal,
came in
like the deal we struck.
Like, yeah, yeah.
150 million. Or
yeah,
something.
It was kind of awkward. He left before he could convince his colleagues that this was a good deal, and when Vestager came in, she immediately went, "Nope, no deal. Back to the drawing board. We're gonna keep on pursuing you."
So, good for her.
Yeah, nice. And she's going up against some of the biggest companies in the world. My second choice is Demis Hassabis, and if you don't know who that is, well, you probably should. He's the co-founder and CEO of DeepMind, which is based in London, and this is the Google-owned artificial intelligence company, who, to my mind, is responsible for one of the most memorable and sort of defining technology stories of the year and potentially of our lives.
Ooh, that's a big claim.
I know. Is it overstating it? So during a week-long competition in South Korea, DeepMind's artificial intelligence went up against the world champion of a board game known as Go, and it was able to defeat it in 4 out of 5 matches played. So it won this series against 17-time world champion Lee Sedol, 4-1. It's incredible.
Tell us the difference in that AI model that between the IBM's is it Deep Blue beating Kasparov in the chess sets, in the chess matches, you know, how it's moved on since then.
Well, chess to my mind and to most people's minds is, you know, this hugely complicated intellectual pursuit. And it is. It's a very difficult game. But there's only a certain number of moves in chess. So that was not an easy problem. It's certainly a very eye-catching problem to solve, but comparatively a very easy problem to solve. The difficulty with Go is that there's such a huge number of moves and a huge number of different possibilities that come about as those move, et cetera, that you need an incredibly smart AI in order to interpret all of the possible outcomes of each and every move and to make the winning move. And what was really interesting is in one of the matches, DeepMind AI made a mistake. It made a really, really big mistake. And that should have meant it lost. But it was able to claw back ground and it won the game.
Blimey. Okay.
And it took hours, but it actually managed to beat the guy. And it's described as one of the enduring challenges of AI, the great challenges of AI. And for me, it was a huge cultural moment. It caused shockwaves in South Korea where this game is, I don't know, it's like Monopoly, but even bigger, I guess it would be like...
Revered, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, it's poker, it's chess, it's everything. It's huge. And the fear of this artificial intelligence beating a 17 times world champion who had predicted beforehand that he would win 4-0 or 5-0.
Yeah, and I think when he was actually playing the AI, he said after one of the games that the AI just made this move that he just had never seen before and couldn't even understand and just couldn't conceptualize how this would actually happen or even like affect the game. And then it easily won after making that move. It was just something that wasn't even like one of the best players in the world could think of or we would even dream of playing. And it's just showing how much that has moved on from the Deep Blue stage and what this artificial intelligence, which learns as it's going along and actually adapted its game throughout the series, and how that actually is coming on and what DeepMind is doing with it.
Yep. So in February 2016, DeepMind also launched DeepMind Health. So it's working in partnership with a number of NHS Foundation trusts in England. So one of those partnerships is to improve detection rates of acute kidney injury. The NHS in England reckons that 1 in 4 cases of acute kidney injury are preventable and that 10,000 lives could be saved each year if detection rates were improved. So working with DeepMind, an app called Streams has been developed, which will help doctors and nurses analyze data from patients and spot trends early and also find new trends and use artificial intelligence to bring out things in data that weren't previously obvious by analyzing huge sums of data. Obviously, this is very controversial with patient privacy, and there's been a lot of stories around that. But we should also say that in July 2016, a collaboration was announced between DeepMind and Moorfields Eye Hospital. That's also in London. And the technology company will use its artificial intelligence to analyze anonymized eye scans to search for early signs of diseases leading to blindness. Again, huge, huge privacy issues here. The issues around patient consent and I'm an NHS patient. Why is my data now being given to a company that's owned by Google? Privacy fears around Google. We've got the European Commission investigating them for things like that and how much access they have to our data and our lives. But it's, and I'm rambling, but it's it's so interesting.
It's massively interesting. I'm sorry, I'm just giggling like a schoolboy that a kidney monitoring app is called Streams. That's all. I've got to just now.
It should be with a Z on the end.
From this conversation because it's far more serious than I'm giving it credit for.
But the list in general, and I'll shut up about DeepMind now, the list in general is, as you say, it's divisive. It's meant to make people disagree and make people agree, but it's so, so difficult to put together a list of 100 people that is absolutely definitive. But this is our best shot at it, and we always really enjoy hearing what people think of it. Who should be higher? Who should be lower? Who do we miss off? Because the list only gets better by people agreeing, disagreeing, absolutely, and having a debate about it. So it was really interesting to hear the people from the list that you thought really stood out and that were worth, you know, talking about in more detail. But the whole list is full of fascinating people. There's 100 of them. So do go and check it out if you haven't already. It's one of the biggest projects that we put together in the year at Wired. And let us know what you think. You can get us on Twitter. I am at Jay Temperton. Jeremy, you are?
At Jeremy Wired.
Well, that's very on brand. I'm at Matt Burgess 1.
And we will see you again next week. Bye-bye.
Goodbye.